From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Dr. James Landers from the University of Virginia is interviewed by Gen's editor-in-chief John Sterling on advances in lab-on-a-chip technology.
Dr. James Landers is professor of chemistry, professor of mechanical engineering, and associate professor of pathology at the University of Virginia. His research is focused on microdevices. Dr. Landers, you and your research team published an article in September in Analytical Chemistry where you wrote about work on a handheld device that may one day house many of the tools found in an analytical laboratory. Would you describe this device and the advantages it holds over traditional laboratories?
Yeah, the devices that are starting to emerge now from numerous research labs are devices that are referred to as lab-on-a-chip devices, primarily because the goal is to condense or miniaturize down the type of macro-scale processes that are associated with doing genetic analysis, extracting DNA from samples, PCR amplifying it, and then looking at some analytical result that indicates some type of genetic information that is either clinically or forensically relevant. And these processes are now at a point in the miniaturization scheme where they're being sequentially linked on single devices that are about the size of a microscope slide and are able to carry out the genetic analysis in time frames that are order of magnitude or more smaller than that of the macroscale counterparts.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on this aspect of your simplifying and miniaturizing analytical processes to allow these operations to be conducted on a microfluidic device?
The beauty of microfluidic devices is that you now take volumes of reagents and samples and protein solutions that are order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude smaller and mobilize them through a micro-plumbing circuit, for lack of a better term, in a planar device that is roughly the size of a microscope slide. What this allows you to do is to do the types of processes that you would do at the macro scale. For example, DNA extraction, where you might extract DNA from a few hundred microliters of human blood and then use that DNA for a downstream process that would involve PCR amplification, making numerous copies of target sequences and then linking that to some clinically relevant outcome. And doing that same DNA extraction in much smaller volumes of blood with much smaller volumes of reagents, and because of the micro-miniaturization, with much faster analysis times. So rather than taking 25 to 45 minutes to do a DNA extraction in a high-throughput robotic type of format, you can do this on the microscale in a few minutes. And primarily because the issues that limit you in the macro scale, diffusion, mixing, are much faster processes in the micro format.
How might physicians, crime scene investigators, pharmacists, even the general public, be able to conduct DNA tests, and what specific applications are involved here?
Well, that's an interesting question, primarily because in an era where we're starting to hear about personalized medicine, that is no longer just a buzzword, but probably on the road to becoming a reality. These types of devices present the possibility that a physician might be able to do a diagnostic assay, a genetic analysis on a particular patient in his office, as opposed to sending the patient to a phlebotomy lab where they do a blood draw and then taking 3 to 5 days to get the analysis done in batch mode in a central lab at a hospital. The ability to do this in less than an hour in the physician's office presents the possibility that in the very same visit, the patient can confer with the physician about the result and whether or not there's any follow-up treatment that's required. So on the physician front, it in many ways changes the way our healthcare can be provided and in a way that benefits the patient. Forensically, it's a slightly different scenario, and that is with a much longer view, we may see the possibility of doing crime scene forensics, DNA identification at the crime scene. I think the jury is still out in terms of whether the forensic community actually wants this. But for those who are very upbeat about the ability of being able to do DNA analysis at the crime scene, the lab on a chip type of device solves a number of problems. Number one, you now input the sample at the site, and you solve a number of chain of custody issues. In other words, you're not doing a DNA extraction in the lab and taking that material and now moving it into a new tube in another lab to do the second part of the process, and so on and so forth for the entire genetic analysis. You have the possibility to put the sample in and get an answer out, which essentially alleviates all of the concerns associated with, do you get a mix-up of samples between processes? So from a forensic point of view, that becomes a pretty enticing characteristic of the technology. You also mentioned the idea of, can the patient at some point anticipate doing their own genetic testing? Now, that's clearly much further down the road, but is it unreasonable to think that if you could package these devices, even in a vending machine type of environment where the vending machine is the instrument, and people wanted to do a quick screen to find out whether or not the respiratory infection they've got is the recent version of the avian flu or whatever the flu du jour is for that particular flu season, is it unrealistic to think that you potentially would have patients who would pay $20 or $30 for a lab on a chip device to pop out, do a needle stick on a finger, put a drop of blood into the device and put it back into the vending machine and get a readout that says, you know, you're negative for the current flu, and therefore you don't have anything to worry about with respect to that, or you're positive and you'd best see a physician immediately. I mean, it's kind of Star Trek-y in many ways, but these devices begin to set up the potential for those types of scenarios to become real.
Lab-on-a-chip technology is a very active area of life science research. Many investigators and biotech companies are exploring this field. What's unique about your device, say, as compared to others currently in development?
I think generically all of the devices are aiming to do the same type of processing, and that is to take some crude sample, whether it be a whole blood sample or a saliva sample or a cheek swab, extract the DNA from that sample in some reasonably purified form, expose it now to the appropriate reagents to do a PCR-based amplification, and then do either the equivalent of an electrophoretic separation or a hybridization reaction or something that gives you a readout that is interpretable from a clinical perspective. All of the devices that are being developed at all of the research institutions that are exploring this are aiming to do those processes. How you do it really is the basis for the nuance of differences that may exist between the various labs. And for example, if we fully exploit what we've learned from the microelectronics industry, the boom of silicon in Silicon Valley in the mid-70s, and incorporate all of the technology that are used to create microelectronic chips into these microanalytical systems, one of the issues that we have to address at some point is that those lab-on-a-chip devices become very expensive. And knowing full well that these devices have to be single-use and disposable raises an issue as to what the market will bear. Our approach has been to take the most simplistic of approaches, and that is to build as little into the microfluidic device as we can, therefore making its fabrication inexpensive. And what we're aiming for are chips that with reagents are in the order of $1 to $5, so that in fact you can begin to anticipate a very cost-effective, very rapid means for doing the same type of diagnostics that are carried out in the clinical labs.
You were quoted as saying that the lab-on-a-chip technology has matured enough during the last 5 years to allow researchers like yourself to seriously consider future possibilities for devices that would allow sample-in, answer-out capabilities from almost anywhere. In which ways has this field matured?
Well, you know, I think one of the milestone developments, came out of Steve Quake's lab when he was at Caltech in the early 2001, 2002. And what Steve had shown was that using soft lithography approaches, they could build very simple, very inexpensive valving solutions into these devices. And one of the things that had really held back this field was we knew full well that we wanted to carry out very different chemistries sequentially on the same device. And that required two things. It required, first of all, that those individual chemistries could be fluidically isolated. In other words, reagents in the DNA extraction part of the chip were actually poisonous to the chemistry that happened in the PCR amplification part of the chip. So in order to isolate those in time, but be able to open up the connection between those two parts of the chip when you were ready to move purified DNA to the PCR domain, required a valving solution. And I think Steve Quake in 01, 02 came up with some elegant solutions. Rich Matthews at Berkeley followed that up with another approach. It happens to be the one that we use. And I think this is what had really opened the floodgates for the people on the chemistry and biochemistry side to see that, in fact, you can have very multifunctional chemistries on a single device without having the various chemistries at certain times interrupt the type of chemistry that had to happen in the individual domains. And I think that was the breakthrough.
Also, this type of research looks to be extremely interdisciplinary. Can you discuss the types of scientific specialists who are working on this technology?
It is, in fact, perhaps one of the most multidisciplinary areas. And I think for those of us who are in this area, that's one of the attractive features of it. You know, early on in the late 80s, early 90s, this was primarily a field for analytical chemists. As the biochemists and biologists started to realize, and the clinical chemists started to realize the potential of doing the very same chemistries we do in our lab, but in the microformat, you started to see an influx of these other fields, crossover into physics and into biology. But at a critical point, it became clear that this was also an engineering challenge, and that at some point the chemistry issues would be resolved. How do you coat the insides of the channels so the proteins wouldn't stick non-specifically? That those types of things would be essentially solved, and now became the issue of how do you now fabricate this device in an inexpensive, very cost-effective way? How do you now package that device into some instrument that is cost-effective, and how do you now have all of the plumbing and all of the chemistries essentially fluidically and electronically actuated in a way that is not only functional but safe? And that gets you into the realm of electrical engineering and mechanical engineering and optical engineering. And so what we're now seeing at meetings like the MicroTAS meeting that will occur in a couple of weeks in San Diego is that you've got this wonderful mixture of applied sciences and hardcore engineering and people coming together in what is the lab on a chip field to essentially tackle all of the problems that are going to be required in order to put one of these devices and one of these instruments into a physician's office and do the type of things that we've talked about.
That leads to my final question. Looking in your crystal ball, when can we expect to see the first approved lab-on-a-chip device on the market, either in the doctor's office or some forensic application? How close are they to actually realizing this technology to where it's almost everyday usage?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, John, and it really is crystal ball for a couple of reasons. But let me just, go out on a limb and give you a number. It's crystal ball because there are issues associated with FDA approval, and we all know that those can be a fairly lengthy path to approval, and so that's an unknown as far as I'm concerned. In terms of actually having devices, I think we're starting to see now at the clinical meetings and at the forensic meetings, lab-on-a-chip devices and the corresponding instrumentation that are starting to translate from the prototype through development and productization to commercialization. Whether that's a 2-year or a 5-year road, it's not clear to me. But I would hope that within 5 years, we've got these instruments in real-world application, in real-world environments, doing real-world things and essentially changing how we do healthcare, changing how we do forensics, and perhaps playing a role on personalized medicine and putting these kinds of tests into, you know, what is clearly an aging baby boomer population that is very educated. And I think, you know, that's part of the whole personalized medicine issue, is that we now have a generation that is educated enough to see the value and may demand that they want to be able to control their own genetic analysis. And so, yeah, 3 to 5 years may be a reasonable ballpark on that.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.